2,000 years ago in Israel, there was a king. Not just a king, there was a group of kings called the Tetrarchs. Rome looked at the family of Herod and said, this family is so evil, and that's a lot for the Roman Empire to say, that we can't possibly leave one of them in charge of Israel, because surely their wickedness and evil will cause Israel to become an impossible place for the Roman Empire to govern. And so they came up with a plan. They split Israel into four pieces and took Herod's four children and put each one of them in charge of a different section of Israel. And they called these kings the Tetrarchs. Rome did this because they believed that if the four children were sort of given their pieces of land, that they would spend all of their time fighting and squabbling with each other. That would make it a lot easier for Rome to be in charge, because they wouldn't have to worry about one powerful Israelite king. Instead, they would have four kings at each other's throats. And, more or less, like most of the things Rome did when it came to politics, it was both brutal and effective. And in fact, Herod's four children, all of whom, confusingly enough, were also named Herod, all ruled in their respective locations. Herod, Philip, was married. Herod, who was king over Jerusalem, was married. But Herod, who was king over Jerusalem, looked at his brother Philip Herod, and he saw that he liked Philip's wife better. And so, they both divorced, and Herod took Philip Herod's wife for his own. It was both a political move and a really, really vicious family move. It came out of nowhere, and it shocked and dismayed the kingdom so much so that John the Baptist made it a point to preach considerably long sermons about the fact that Herod had unrighteously married his sister-in-law, and in this way brought shame not just to the throne, but to all of Israel. And he continued to preach this even when it became very clear that if he did so, Herod, the king of Jerusalem, not Philip Herod, was going to become very violent. King Herod placed John the Baptist in prison. While in prison, King Herod's wife, you know, the one that used to be married to his brother, this is a soap opera at this point, convinced her daughter to convince King Herod to behead John the Baptist. So this is the political reality of Jerusalem in the moment that Jesus is currently alive. And so when the Pharisees and the Sadducees come to Jesus and they say to him, "Teacher, what do you think about divorce? This isn't just a socially charged question. This is a politically charged question." Because they want more than anything else for Jesus to step right into John the Baptist's shoes in hopes that he will also step right into John the Baptist's jail cell and then right into the executioner's block right next to where John the Baptist had been. They've carefully set out a plan for the exclusive purpose of seeing if Jesus will fall the same way John the Baptist fell. So they say to him, "Teacher, we are curious about this teaching." Now, in Jesus' day, this teaching was not an easy teaching. It was very, very controversial, debated heavily, and I don't think 2,000 years later anything has much changed. Anyone who has ever had a marriage break up and gone through a divorce knows that there's absolutely nothing pleasant about the experience. Anybody who's ever experienced that level of breakup knows that there is sorrow, there is pain, there is hurt. In Jesus' day, the sorrow, the pain, and the hurt was multiplied by about 10 for the women who got divorced, because a woman who got divorced ceased to have any claim whatsoever on any of her husband's property and or money. So if a woman was divorced, especially if she had children, those that woman and her children ceased to have any form of financial support. Being divorced in Jesus' day was almost a certain sentence that you were going to become destitute. And so it wasn't just that Jesus was being prompted by the Pharisees to get himself in political trouble. He was also being prompted by the Pharisees to get himself in cultural trouble. And so they ask him, "What do you say, teacher?" And Jesus says, "What did Moses tell you that you could do? What did Moses give you permission to do?" And the Israelites, who were relying on Moses as their leadership and guidance, said, "Well, Moses said we can do it if we want to." Jesus says to them, "Moses said that to you because you're hard-hearted. Moses said that to you because you are not kind to one another. But I tell you this, I am going to request and require that you not be hard-hearted. I'm going to request and require that you not be cruel to one another. I'm going to request and require that you treat each other with kindness and decency. I'm going to tell you that you may not do this thing that Moses has permitted you to do. You may not leave women and children destitute just because you want to." And of course, this did not go over well. Jesus was questioned repeatedly by the Pharisees and the Sadducees in ways designed to get him trouble with culture and with politics. Jesus answered with courage. And if you look at the passage, you have to wonder to yourself, why did the gospel writer, why did Mark transition from this conversation about Jesus giving this very difficult teaching on marriage and divorce directly to this conversation about Jesus welcoming the children? Because it does seem like an odd transition, almost like they took two stories and stuck them together without a transition. And I know when I'm working with my kids, I'm the family paper editor. Whenever there's a school paper to be turned in, the rule is you got to run it past dad first. And I'm going to be looking for some things like, when you write your paragraphs, do you give them smooth transitions from one to the other? Because English teachers like it when there's a good transition from one paragraph to the next. Well, it's almost like the Gospel of John needed somebody to come in and do a little editing work, because that transition's terrible. He's moved from one topic to another, and it's just a little bit of whiplash here. But of course, the point is, he wasn't moving from one topic to another. When Jesus tells the Pharisees, "No, you may not offer certificates of divorce to the women," it was because he understood exactly what was going to happen to the most helpless segment of the population that lived in his world of that day. And who was going to be the most hurt in the process? Well, the children. So when they bring the children to Jesus and say, "We would like you to bless our children," and the actual disciples are like, no, we don't want the children. They're just send them away. Jesus says, no. I am here for the weakest segment of the population. I am here for those who need the most. I am here for those who require mercy above all else. In fact, I am here for those who think of themselves as children, those who have no power, those who have no social status. I'm there for the children. I've often mentioned the fact that the word for child in Greek is doulos. Doulos can be interpreted child. It can also be interpreted slave. Something that every so often you might want to remind your own children at home when you send them to do their chores. You're like, "You know, the word in Greek also means slave, so take out the trash." Jesus is speaking to this crowd of people and he says, no, 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 welcome the children. I welcome the children. I bless the children. And if you want to enter into the kingdom of God, you need to be helpless like this child. You need to be someone who needs supported, someone who needs strengthened. You need to embrace your weakness as a human being. Because in embracing your weakness as a human being, you recognize that you need my grace. One of the best metaphors for God's grace, mercy, and forgiveness that I've ever come across is the notion that every human being walks around accumulating stuff. I don't know if you've ever been to Prairie Peddler. Prairie Peddler is going on right now. If you've not, you should probably go today because it is a lot of fun. If you've never been there, Prairie Peddler is a giant outdoor market that's over towards, it's beyond Belleville. It's this incredible location where you walk through the woods and there's store after store and shop after shop of every art and craft that has ever been arted or crafted. And we go pretty much every year. And you know, most of the stands are there year after year after year. And you would think that we would kind of get there one year and walk around and be like, well, we've seen all this stuff before, let's go home. That never happens. That never happens. Because we walk from stall to stall and stand to stand and we try the hot chocolate. We're like, oh, that's really good. We need a bag of that. And we try the popcorn. We're like, oh, that's really good. We need a bag of that. And we walk through the wrought iron craftsman. And we say, well, you know, that's a really neat yard ornament. That I don't recognize that one. That's really cool. We need one of those. And then we just keep walking through accumulating stuff. Dried flowers and eucalyptus bunches and candles and candles. And candles, and candles. It just, you know, you accumulate all this stuff. And by the end of the day, your hands are full. By the end of the day, it's just you and bags and a great big piece of wrought iron, which we have now gone to great effort to purchase last. That's the pro move at Prairie Peddler. If you're going to buy something stone or metal, get it last. And so here we are, and we're walking with, you know, hands full of stuff. And you're kind of almost to the point where you can't buy anything else. You're out of hands. That's how you know it's time to leave Prairie Peddler. You have nothing left, hand-wise, to hold on to anything else. That's what it means to live as a human being. We live from day to day filling our hands. Our hands are filled with events, duties, requirements. Our hands are filled with problems, fears. Our hands are filled with other people's problems and fears. We find ourselves walking day to day with this increasing load of burden. All of which we would never part with because it took us forever to accumulate all this stuff, right? I mean, somebody came up to you, Prairie Peddler, and said, wow, I really love that great big wrought iron cross you got. It looks pretty heavy. Would you give it to me? We'd be like, no, go get your own. But at some point, we as human beings become overburdened. Life becomes more than we can carry. We become exhausted from the weight of the things we bear. And God stands in our midst and he says, I want to bless you, just like he wanted to bless the children. I want to give you mercy and grace and forgiveness, and I want to give it into your hands such that you can carry this new burden that isn't a burden, but is instead lightness and strength and hope. And the problem is our hands are so full of stuff that we've accumulated that we don't want to let go of. See, when Jesus puts a small child in their midst and blesses them and says, if you want to enter into the kingdom of heaven, you must be like one of these, it's partially because their hands are empty. They haven't accumulated all this stuff yet. All of these expectations, all of these accomplishments and troubles and trials and failings and successes, their hands are empty. They've got nothing but open hands. God cannot place his blessing in your hands if you're holding on to the things this world gives you. It is a simple reality that if you want to take God's blessings from his hands that he wants to eagerly offer you, you can't let your hands be filled with all of this world's problems, hopes, failures, successes. Are we willing to set down everything that we are carrying at the foot of the cross and say, these are no longer what matter to me most? Instead, are we willing to make our hands empty such that God might place his grace and mercy, his love and his forgiveness in our hands as though we are children? To some, the notion of laying down all of our worldliness at the cross sounds like an enormous blessing, because instead of carrying around successes and happiness and accomplishments and wealth, what they're carrying around is sorrow and fear and anxiety and hopelessness. Having somewhere to set that down sounds like an enormous blessing. And those people oftentimes find it easier to lay their burdens down at the cross and open their hands to receive the gift of grace and forgiveness. For some, though, they're walking around with an armload full of stuff that they've gone out of their way to pick up. It is difficult to hear the call of the gospel that says, whatever it is that you've accumulated that you think is worth something, what I have is worth more. Whatever you think that you've accumulated that is blessing, I will bless you more. Whatever it is that you think that you're carrying around that makes you great, I will make you greater. And yet that is what the voice of Christ is saying to this crowd as he welcomes the least of them, the children. So I say to you all on this Sunday morning, our Christ, who was not afraid to speak the truth in the face of the Pharisees, not afraid to offend King Herod, not afraid to do and say what needed to be done and said in order that he might extend the gospel message to those who need to hear it most, may you hear that message just as clearly today. That God's grace is offered to you. And it's not like it's offered once. It's offered every day, every moment, every second of your life. Christ stands before you trying to hold out to you more of what it is that heaven wants to offer. All we have to do is be willing to set aside our human expectations, set aside our human vices, our human problems, our human successes, our human abilities, and place them all at the foot of the cross and say, here, Lord, this is for you, and open our hands and receive the grace that God has prepared for us. Amen.